Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. An eviction moratorium set in place since March of 2020 is set to expire at the end of this month. It was intended to protect those who've been economically impacted by the pandemic. Rent relief programs were put into place, but a slow distribution of money has really been an issue since the programs were created. The state auditor released a report earlier this month saying the state is at risk of losing $337 million, money meant to be allocated towards rental assistance. The report also showed that the need is there, citing the state housing department has received applications for rental assistance totaling nearly $1 billion and for utilities assistance totaling over $100 million that it has not yet processed. And all of these numbers are as of September 8th. That's 2 weeks ago. Some are worried about a possible eviction tsunami in October after protections are lifted. Here to help us better understand how tenant advocates feel about the process of applying for assistance and their concerns about the end of the eviction moratorium is CAP Radio's race and equity reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, welcome back to Insight.
Good to be here, Vicki. Thank you.
Well, Sarah, tell us a little bit more about this moratorium. And when it comes to people who live in the greater Sacramento area right now, who still needs those protections that are set to expire in just a few days?
Yeah, so this eviction protection moratorium was put in place last year when the pandemic first began. And initially, it prevented landlords from evicting pretty much anyone. So, even if it was not pandemic related. But eventually that evolved to a ban on evictions if tenants had suffered from pandemic related income loss. It was extended three times over the past year and a half. And in its last extension in June, legislators had set the sunset date as September with the hopes that the economy would be back to normal in the next 3 months. But some advocates said that even back in June, they believed these protections were going to be ending way too soon.
When it comes to housing, what are housing advocates concerned about when it comes to this moratorium expiring?
Housing advocates say they're very concerned about a wave of evictions that you mentioned that may come once this moratorium expires. Currently, according to National Equity Atlas, that's an initiative run by PolicyLink and the University of Southern California, over 34,000 households in Sacramento are still behind on rent. The average amount of rent that they owe is nearly $3,000 each. So there absolutely still is a significant number of people who are still struggling to make their rent right now. And with numbers like that, advocates like Autumn Gonzalez, she's a volunteer with NorCal Resist, say that for the people she works with, the pandemic and its impacts are far from being over.
A lot of people are back at work. The folks that we work with who tend to be immigrant families, a lot of undocumented families or mixed status. But a lot of people do not have their full hours back yet. So they're not making as much money as they were making prior to the pandemic. And then there's just a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen with the economy and fear. So I do, even though I understand that we all want to get back to normal, but things are not back to normal for a lot of low-wage workers yet.
And I also spoke with Claire Tauber with the Sacramento Eviction Defense Network. She says her organization has gotten a lot of calls from tenants who are very worried about the upcoming deadline.
People are really nervous about it ending. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, their circumstances have not really changed. Up until this point. And in the past, with protections, with the COVID protections we've had, they've been renewed at the last minute. But that's not what's going to happen this time around, most likely. It doesn't look like there's any movement to extend these protections. So we've gotten a lot of calls from tenants that are really nervous about what's going to happen once the protections are lifted.
Well, Sarah, is there anything to quell that nervousness? Are there safeguards in place once this expires at the end of the month?
Yeah, there definitely are. You know, you mentioned pandemic rent relief. There have been a number of, I guess there's the federal pandemic rent relief program, and there's also Sacramento has, a local level rent relief program as well. For tenants who are having trouble paying rent, they can always apply for that. But the Sacramento Eviction Defense Network says the issue with that is that a lot of folks who are most in need of this rental assistance typically are actually the ones who are probably least likely to be able to access it, just due to things like limited English proficiency or, you know, lack of proper technology even to apply?
We've definitely worked with a lot of people who are monolingual in another language, which presents a lot of barriers because a lot of the documentation is only presented in English. There's a lack of communication between the management and the tenants, and there's lots of intimidation that's used, and people are, especially people who are maybe monolingual or undocumented, they have a lot of fear and they don't want to rock the boat because they have a lot of things at stake and they don't know their rights and they don't know their protections.
And we're going to get a bigger perspective from property owners because they're an important piece of this and have been impacted. But through your reporting, what are landlords and property owners saying about this moratorium ending?
Yeah, you know, I've heard from landlord organizations who have said they're definitely feeling relieved that the moratorium is finally lifting. Many have told me that the rest of the state has returned to business as usual, but landlords have kind of remained in this state of limbo, and that's been unfair. And both landlords and tenant activists, they all seem to agree that the moratorium was in no way a perfect solution. You know, there have been loopholes throughout the pandemic, and there have been landlords who have exploited those loopholes around evictions, as I've heard from some advocates. And that was especially pronounced when it came to these more vulnerable populations, like families who are undocumented or who don't speak English very well. Advocates have said that for people who lived in large commercially owned properties, these eviction protections probably worked the best and most in the way they were supposed to. But for tenants and landlords in smaller situations, which is a great majority of people in the Sacramento area, so these are individual landlords of houses or duplexes, a lot of advocates have said that these were situations where the moratorium was just not strong enough. It just wasn't working for a number of reasons. They say that while it was, of course, better than nothing, it really wasn't keeping folks from getting evicted.
Sarah, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Of course. Thanks so much, Vicki.
And that is CAP Radio race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about California's eviction moratorium coming to an end at the end of this month. I want to bring in Deborah Carlton. She's the executive vice president of the California Apartment Association. Deborah, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Good morning, Vicki.
You know, some have feared this, you know, quote, eviction tsunami will happen starting next month. I mean, is that really a fair assessment?
You know, I appreciate the fact that that this tagline is being used all the time, but that's just not what is going to happen at the end of September. The California legislature included some protections for tenants. And what the law provides is that a landlord cannot proceed with an eviction unless they can demonstrate that they've applied for dollars under the state or local program and that the tenant didn't qualify and or the tenant should have been paying the rent all along. And unfortunately, that's what we're finding is happening now.
So essentially, loopholes also being used by tenants, not only landlords and property owners.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. You know, I know a majority of owners in a large majority of owners and tenants are good, honest, hardworking individuals. I think because the law was so easy to manipulate, if you will, you had to take the tenant's word for it that they had been negatively affected by COVID. Now that they have to prove they've been affected by COVID, when the tenants apply for the money, the landlords are being told that these tenants don't qualify. So those 18 months in many cases where the landlord received no rent, they can probably just expect to not receive anything. That tenant will probably leave and never pay.
Weren't landlords also able to apply for rental assistance? And what has that process been like?
Sure. So in the process at the state and local level, both have to apply. So the landlord has to apply and the tenant. So it's a dual process. Often the landlord will apply and the tenant won't, even with follow-up by government officials and prodding from the landlord to please apply. These tenants don't because they probably don't qualify. Some of the tenant advocates were speaking to the fact that some tenants may be afraid. There's multi-languages that are available in all of these aspects, not to mention anybody who's undocumented is still eligible for the dollars. And I think what we're hoping is that the tenant organizations are helping these tenants apply for the funds. I know that landlords and tenants that have a really good relationship sit down together at a computer and fill out the forms.
What do you want people to better understand when it comes to landlords and property owners across our state? Because the vast majority are smaller scale, not large commercially owned properties, correct?
Correct. Yeah. In California, it's a very small owner based population. So most of the housing in California is situated in single family and duplexes. Those owners, of course, are applying for funds because they have to. It used to be prior to this latest iteration of the state law, it was voluntary. But now owners can be paid 100% of the past rent that's owed. It's really to their advantage to apply. And coming forward, you can't proceed with the eviction on October 1st unless you have applied. So bottom line is work with your tenants to make that application. And I would say to tenants, communicate with your landlord. That is key in making sure that you're both applying for the funds.
I guess what stories, since you're talking directly with landlords and property owners, what stories can you share that helps us get a wider lens of this issue and the gravity of it and potential consequences?
Well, I think the stories, of course, what we hear are unfortunately the negative ones where you have a senior citizen landlord, this is their retirement dollars, and the tenant doesn't qualify, and yet state law has allowed that tenant to live there rent-free for almost 18 months. I mean, that's the most unfortunate thing. We're going to work with the legislature in December and January to try to find some help for those landlords. Even though a landlord can apply if the tenant left, because maybe a tenant moved home with their parents or, found a different job, the landlord can apply for those tenants who left, and that's an important thing to note. However, they have to have kept in touch with that tenant because that tenant still has to apply and verify that that was the rent that was owed. So those are big pieces here for those tenants who don't qualify, those tenants who left, and then the communication piece. Landlords, you have to apply in order to even proceed with an eviction.
I'm curious because we've learned this in so many different sectors and arms of our society. Did the pandemic just intensify existing challenges when it comes to California's rental market?
It did to some degree. Of course, we know that there's not enough housing in California, ownership housing or rental housing. This legislature tried to protect those tenants so that they wouldn't be moved along, provided dollars for them, because it is hard to find another place to live. Now, there were some reports that came out of the federal government that said many tenants' credit scores actually improved during the pandemic. They were able to be protected from these evictions. And also, they received extra dollars, as you know, from the state or federal government to help them pay the bills. And now with the dollars that are still available, they can receive assistance here as well.
Yeah, I'm just curious, is the crux of the issue tenants who say they can't afford to pay, or is it the actual moratorium and the language of it that was enacted about 18 months ago, or is there just a deeper problem here?
I don't know if there's a deeper problem. I think that it's just about the application process, making sure that it's clean. We did work with the administration to make that application process easier, especially for tenants. You have to provide a lot of paperwork. You have to make sure you have your lease. That's why you want to work with a copy of your lease, work with your landlord. They have to provide it. The very beginning of the pandemic, owners were not allowed to evict and can probably not ever evict for some of that past rent because tenants are protected about the first 6 months of the pandemic. Even if they don't pay, they're protected. So that is a concern. Now, owners in the end could probably go to small claims court to collect that, but that's going to be very challenging as well.
Are you hearing situations of when it comes to smaller property owners that are renting out, a duplex or single family rentals, that they may have to sell their home or go into foreclosure?
Yeah, that's the only way that some of these smaller property owners are going to make it. Some did have to sell early on, and I think that's probably what some of the tenants would call a loophole, but they had to sell. Otherwise, they would lose to foreclosure. the bank would have taken it anyway, and the owner and the tenant would have both lost out. So I think that's one of the issues that is hard, because owners didn't qualify for federal dollars to help them pay the mortgage. And so that was obviously a big concern for some of these small mom and pops.
And when reading the San Francisco Chronicle, there was an article that San Francisco had tried to extend the moratorium within the city until the end of the year, but ultimately was unable to because of state law. Your association, the California Apartment Association, wrote a letter opposing this. I'm just curious if you can expand on your concerns about extending the moratorium.
Sure. Consistency is key, so that owners know and tenants know how this all works. If you have hundreds of local laws that are very different, judges would have to apply this differently. We've already created, and the courts have already created forms so that they're consistent throughout the state. So even come October 1st, tenants are still protected. San Francisco did not need to do some extension that would have allowed tenants to live for free for another 3 months. That was unnecessary. Tenants just need to apply for money. It's available. San Francisco had 4,100 applications they hadn't even responded to. It was a big concern for us. They finally are turning over their applications to the state so that those tenants could be paid and the landlords can be paid. So there was no reason at all for San Francisco to allow tenants to live rent-free for another 3 months.
Finally, for both property owners and tenants who are listening, because we're just in the final days of this, come October 1st and following October 1st, in what situation can a landlord evict a tenant?
So come October 1st, if you're applying for money, you still have to wait another 20 days, the landlord does, to see if the tenant qualifies. And only then, and that's if you're evicting because of non-payment of rent, which is predominantly the situations, you've got to wait to see if the tenant qualifies. And only then, and I would say it would be in November, can you then proceed with the eviction. And even then there's backstops. So a tenant could come in later and say, well, I did qualify and I do qualify and here's my proof. So you could even get down the road, you know, 3 months into the eviction process, because they are not overnight. and you would then end up with a tenant saying, I have the money. I mean, most owners will say, great. Of course, it's going to cost the owners quite a bit of money to go to court. That's why they don't want to go to court. You've got to use an attorney, and it's expensive.
Deborah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that is Deborah Carlton, the Executive Vice President of the California Apartment Association. Up next, two beloved locally owned restaurants join us for a roundtable of sorts on navigating the ever-challenging pandemic. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. When the COVID-19 pandemic really started to take a hold in the United States, the sector of the economy that really hit home the dire situation facing all of us was, and still is, the service industry. We're talking hotels, travel, tourism, and of course, restaurants. Millions of people were out of work, tens of thousands of restaurants were forced to close dining, and many of them closed for good. Since the shutdowns went into effect last year, we've spoken to a number of restaurant owners and managers about how they're navigating the closures. Now, with the state reopened, vaccines out, and despite less severe restrictions in place, even with the Delta variant, the challenges are still very much present. We're going to get a status check on how the local industry is surviving, given the constant body blows it has sustained. Joining us today are Chris Barnum-Dan, owner and executive chef of Sacramento's Localis Restaurant, and Ryan Rose, president of Zocalo Restaurants. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning.
Ryan, Zocalo has several locations in the greater Sacramento area, including a new one in Folsom, which opened during a pandemic, no less. Can you talk to us about how many people Zocalo employs between your locations and really what the biggest challenge is for you right now?
Absolutely. And actually, We just turned 17 years old there in Midtown Sacramento. And as you said, our last opening was in Folsom, which not only was during a pandemic, but was also during the fires, which was incredibly challenging because the only patio, or I'm sorry, the only dining room you had was on a patio full of smoke. Each restaurant of ours employs roughly 100 employees. And the biggest heartache of last year was the amount of times that we unfortunately had to lay staff off. And what we continued to do throughout that year was to stay as innovative as possible through to-go, stay open so that whenever we had the opportunities to reopen, we would bring our staff back in.
Are you fully staffed right now, or are you also experiencing shortages? We've been hearing that from a lot of small business owners.
What's been incredible about 2021 is the major publications were starting to term the beginning of the year as the restaurant renaissance. We were supposed to come back and everyone was going to flood back in. The problem has been not only are we carrying the debts of 2020, not only are we tired because of the survival of 2020, we have met new challenges. There has been major staff shortages. We have seen inflation and supply issues. And in 3 months, we're getting ready to see what is the last step towards $15 minimum wage. And so we have walked steadily with each challenge that comes and only see it as that, as a challenge, because we are true Sacramentans. We're proud to be Sacramentans. And we want to continue to show that the local restaurateur owns the city.
Chris, you own Localis in Midtown Sacramento. It's a Michelin-listed restaurant and more intimate fine dining. I mean, it just explained kind of the journey you've gone through over the last 18 months and the challenges that you and your staff have faced.
Well, we started off at the beginning of the pandemic with 25 employees. And as soon as everything was shut down, we lost almost everybody right away. And for us, the difficult part was pivoting. You know, it wasn't easy for any restaurant out there. But for a fine dining restaurant that based itself in tasting menus and wine pairings, it's pretty hard to put that into a box and send it home with people. And knowing that our, you know, whereas, you know, trying to have as many people with an average cover come into the restaurant versus our business model, which is more so of like the price cover is much higher per person and there's far less people. So it's really hard to garner those kind of those numbers when you're sending things to go. And we pivoted doing tasty menus to go, which ended up being really successful for us. We retained a couple of our staff. A lot of our staff didn't want to return to do work. And as soon as we were funded with a PPP, we offered everyone work back, and a lot of people didn't want to come back to work. So getting through the year was tough, but we made it. It was a lot of hard work from a very small team. I think we learned a lot about ourselves and what we're able to do with a very small team during that time. And as we reopened, we kept the team very small, and we pay the team, you know, far higher than I think most other restaurants can or would pay. But that's because we want to retain a small staff of people that we know are very in to win, per se. And we feel very fortunate to be able to be open again, and have people come into the doors. And, I guess the same as Ryan said, we're kind of the kings, and queens of learning to deal with, you know, everything, because I think the pandemic hit us the hardest. I really do think that restaurants took the brunt of all of it. And like you mentioned, our supply chain is not that affected. We deal with very small farmers and very high-end ingredients, which haven't really had the market impact of commodity products like a lot of restaurants have to use in order to make numbers. So it's been a little bit easier for us on the supply side. We haven't really had to deal with that too much. And we do have the staff that we need. We are fully staffed for what we're looking for. But it's been a pretty incredible journey. And I will say that the weight that people carry around, so often, I think we talk about the employees, and as an employer, I know it's hard to talk about it, but the stress that we went through as owners, as people that really cared about the people that we hired, that we work with, in our communities, I think we had to bear a lot of stress and just a lot of mental health issues throughout COVID, trying to figure out what to do, how to do it, how to keep people employed, how to keep people happy. It was a really tough year, but I still to this day will say it was the best year of my life. It taught me more about myself and what I want to do in business than any other year previous.
Hmm. Are you fully staffed or are you still trying to hire back staff?
No, we're fully staffed. We had a couple people last from before COVID times, but we hired on fairly new staff during COVID for the To-Go program, and all of those people stayed on as we reopened.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking about your location. I mean, was even outdoor dining feasible for Localis?
No. And we tried to petition the city to, we have an enclosed patio for the most part with huge windows that open. And we tried to petition the city to let us do, you know, very small amounts of people in there with the windows open. But that wasn't allowed, which was hard when you saw the tents that were completely enclosed. It didn't feel like there was very much difference. I can honestly say that my biggest gripe with the whole situation during COVID was that everyone got treated the same regardless of where they were at or how their business ran or what their model was. Everyone, you know, got said, well, hey, this is what we do. But then certain people were able to have, you know, street side dining, which would have been great for us, but it wasn't possible on our corner because it's red zones on both sides of us. So we were just kind of left with only the one option of doing to go. So we just put all of our eggs in that basket and did the best that we could.
Hmm. Ryan, how did Zocalo survive? I mean, was it curbside, to-go options, outdoor dinings, even PPE loans? Or was there something in particular that helped offset the losses that you were facing?
There's no regaining those losses, I can tell you that. And there was a time coming into this year that I could tell you we had 5 weeks of cash left in the bank. And if there's anything that pushed us through, it was our team. And there's this driving hope and this push to succeed, meaning there's no other option for us. And we will show up and open the restaurant and we'll close it down at night because families depend on us. And the hundreds of employees that are in each of our restaurants depend on us. So as we were transitioning and going from that day of last year in March of having to shut down, the following day we were 100% to go. To us, the decision to get into the to-go game happened years ago. It was something that was already on our horizon, which allowed us to pivot that much quicker. And every time we were allowed to open back up, we are fortunate to have patios already. It's been part of our game plan of our restaurants and the type of restaurant that we have to have big patios. So we were fortunate enough to bring the dine in on that side and continue to evolve and move into whatever challenge was next. The other big piece that that allowed us to have flexibility was, you know, as Jim Collins said, technology is an accelerator. And so we stayed is extremely efficient and continued to move with our online ordering system. Even now, when we do see challenges with staff shortages, we're able to control our flow through our reservation system. And we've also brought in Toast, which actually just went public yesterday, a POS company. A software company, and we're using a type of ordering system that allows guests to order themselves when they want, how they want it, whenever they want. And so even if we may be staffed lighter than we would like, because we have a higher tolerance for the tech that's out there, and we only continue, it will greaten, we have been able to stay at about 90% of the sales that we saw in 2019, which has kind of been our comparison for ourselves.
I've used the Toast app. Yeah, you can order from your table. You can even pay from your phone. You can reorder drinks and things like that. I'm curious, does that change the dining experience at Zocalo?
What we care about is what we call true Mexican hospitality. And the old model, the model that's always been there for restaurants, has been for someone to place your order. And what we're starting to see, and the way we think about it, is that it is a technical item that has been needed to get the order in. Because of last year, there's almost like we were able to leverage the fact that people have been placing orders through their phone all last year online. It was the only way you could place an order, right? So it's allowed us to move on this even quicker into this year. Now, at face value, it seems a little weird. But what I can say is when we were coming into this, we kind of had two options. We were going to be short-staffed and have extremely slow service. We're a style of restaurant that's volume. So there's big days over the weekends that we can see 1,000 people come into one of our restaurants a day per location. It's tons of volume. So we have to constantly be watching how we're getting to tables. An interesting article that I read last year said, as a society, we have become 4 minutes less patient. What we used to be okay waiting 10 minutes for, we're now only okay waiting 6 minutes. And so to have a technology like this is, if I am your server and I am busy, you can place your order. And even if I'm at a separate table, someone else will bring your drink when you're ready. If and maybe there's everyone's experienced the time where you're ready, waiting to pay the check. You have to get back to work. You have to get home because it's time to get the kids ready for shower time and bedtime and homework. There's no longer the need to wait for your check. There's no longer the need to swipe a card. There's no longer the need to wait for your credit card to come back for you to sign it. And so we have limited these times throughout a typical restaurant experience where you are waiting on us to get back to you, and you are actually controlling your time and doing things as you please.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're joined by two guests, Chris Barnum Dan, owner and executive chef of Sacramento's Localis Restaurant, and Ryan Rose, president of Zocalo Restaurants. You know, Chris, you know, you said that the last 18 months was, you know, obviously challenging, but it also was one of the best years of your life because it taught you a lot of lessons. I'm curious, when looking at the future, what excites you about fine dining in Sacramento?
The fact that it's here. I think that, you know, for so long, not to say there was no fine dining, but it was definitely not something that was prevalent. And when I opened Localis, I could literally name off the heaviest hitters in the town that told me, do not open this restaurant. It's a bad idea. Sacramento doesn't want that. And I just had a vision of bringing the dining experience that I love, which is more of an experience base. I mean, I love food in general. I think a street taco on a corner can be as euphoric of experience. I mean, we have a dish on our menu right now based on a bagel that I had in Lower East Side of Manhattan, you know, so every food can be amazing. And I just love food in general, but the experience part is what I wanted to do for people. And I think in the future, it made me that much more, secured in the idea that we need to find great work-life balance. I achieved that during COVID for the first time in my entire life, and it taught me a lot about how much and how important my family matters to me. The people around me that I love matter to me, my community. And I think moving forward, we're just excited that we get to have the opportunity to give Sacramento an experience that they it's harder to find in Sacramento than anything else. And I think that we're really focused on our staff right now. I think it's become the most important thing for us. So 4-day work weeks, salaried pay, month paid vacation. I mean, all of these things are not possible for a lot of restaurants to do. We have the possibility, and we feel it's our responsibility to do everything that we can for our staff first, because we found very quickly that the happier the staff is, the happier the guest is in our world. And that's what we look forward to the most, are the lessons that we learned about what is important, you know, and really making sure that the people that are working for us are taken care of first, because that's who's going to take care of the guests. I'm not personally going to take care of every guest. So for me to be in one place is fine, but for the whole staff to be in another place is the goal that we're after now. And I think we're achieving that so far. So we'll see what happens.
You also turned the pandemic kind of into an opportunity. You took some time to renovate Localis. What inspired you to do that?
We had been talking about it before. We had lost so much money on the J Street location. We were paying rent there. We had the architect plans done. And as we looked at it, it just seemed so unreasonable to try to think about building out and opening a new restaurant during pandemic times. And, you know, we were in good communication with the landlords there. They're great people. And we just came to the conclusion that it wasn't smart for us, but we knew that we couldn't stay in our location the way that it was and do what we wanted to do in the future. So we had to take the time to renovate Localis and to give it a breath of fresh air. I also think that it falls in line with, I'm a very different person now than I was 18 months ago. And the way that I interact with everything in the world is different. And part of the idea of renovating Localis, giving it a new look, was kind of that same idea that I don't want to walk into the same restaurant and have that same history be there. I want something new and something fresh. And I want every person that works at Localis and comes into Localis to have the opportunity to walk into a new restaurant, even though it's still Localis, we still do the same thing that we've always done. There's a new purpose, a new identity for us. And we're trying to make sure that every aspect of the business sees that new identity.
And I can imagine that symbolism from you personally also translates into the dining experience for customers when they walk in to something that feels different, like a new chapter.
Yeah, definitely. It's been great.
Ryan, I want to ask you the same question. What excites you about the restaurant scene moving forward?
It's constant innovation. We are on a bigger scale and we are on a path to grow. And so when you're hit with challenges like this, for us, we've always been this group that's like, we can't sit and feel bad for ourselves for the current situation we're in. And what pushes us is to create whatever it can be next. And a lot of times it's something that you've never thought of. And so the beauty of this moment has been, who are we? What else can we do? What is the most important to us is our core purpose, and that is caring about the guest experience more than they do. Past that, it can open up the opportunity to go, hey, Zocalo is about experience. Zocalo is about true Mexican hospitality. Zocalo is about being a modern Mexican. And so it tells you, you don't just have to do dine-in restaurants. In fact, one of our locations on Fair Oaks and Howe, 20% to this day, 20% of our sales are coming in through to-go revenue. We have launched a grab-and-go program on Sac State's campus for the students and faculty members there. We're in negotiation, and we're also talking about other items that we can sell wholesale, whether it be our salsas or the enchilada sauces or our mole sauce that comes from 26 different ingredients and takes a full day to cook. Because of last year, we opened up a centralized kitchen, commissary kitchen in West Sacramento that also doubles as a ghost kitchen for Zocalo to ghost. So now, because of this challenge and looking at it as do something, we have created more opportunities. And what you'll see at the beginning of next year is a new concept coming from us. Too early to tell you exactly what it's looking like, but it is going to be separate of Zocalo, but the most important thing is it's us, and our group is tight. Our group has been committed for more than 17 years. Ernesto Jimenez has been in this industry, and to me is one of the people who paved the way for what eating downtown is with Ernesto's 30 years ago this year. And we take the depth of our team, and we allow the newness, right, of the staff who's coming in the door, the ones that we're saying are in shortage, we see it as an opportunity to learn and see that there's many different perspectives on how we can continue to grow. Because when we grow as a company, people's lives change. And I can tell you that that happened for myself. Coming in as a bar back 17 years ago and now being president, every time we are able to grow as a business, opportunities come and people are able to navigate through that and stay part of our family.
We only have about 30 seconds left. And Chris, I just want to end with you because you spent some time on a national cooking show. Can you just tell us about your experience on Food Network's The Globe?
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. I needed something during COVID to spark some sort of interest in what I do for a living. So it was really fun to be able to do a little travel and to be on in a situation I've never been in before. It was really fun had a blast and didn't expect to win, but obviously did. And just really thankful I had the opportunity to do something like that during a time like COVID.
Well, congratulations. We're actually lucky to have both of you and your restaurants in Sacramento.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And that is Chris Barnum Dan, owner and executive chef of Sacramento's Localis Restaurant, and Ryan Rose, president of Zocalo Restaurants. Still ahead, local comedians are honoring a Folsom Marine sergeant severely injured during suicide bombings in Kabul. Really the best way they know how, with laughter. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's been a month since suicide bombings at Hamid Karzai International Airport claimed the lives of 13 U.S. service members and 170 Afghans. The attack in Kabul, happening in the closing days of the U.S. withdrawal of Afghanistan, and the consequences and uncertainty is persevering. This weekend, a memorial was held for 23-year-old Marine Sergeant Nicole G. from Roseville, with an outpouring from the community that lined the sidewalks to the highway and the interstate. There is also an outpouring of support for another local service member severely injured from those bombings. Sergeant Tyler Vargas Andrews is from Folsom, currently undergoing relentless medical procedures due to severe injuries sustained. As the 23-year-old faces a long medical journey, those from near and far are stepping in to help. Sergeant Vargas Andrews' team leader started a GoFundMe, which as of this morning has raised more than $300,000. Locally, two comedians are joining forces, hosting a benefit show to raise even more for his family. Mike Betancourt and Joey C. join us now with more on the Tyler Vargas Andrews Benefit Show, taking place October 14th in the city of Lincoln. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Yeah, Joey, what is your relationship with Tyler?
Before I state that, can I read a statement from the family?
Yes, please do.
The family of U.S. Marine Corps Sergeant Tyler Justin Vargas Andrews, 23, confirms that he was one of the injured United States Marines in the suicide bombing attack at Hamid Karzai International Airport in Kabul, Afghanistan on Thursday, August 26, 2021. Sergeant Vargas Andrews is currently receiving emergency medical care at Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington, D.C. Andrew's injuries are extensive, and he has undergone 18 surgeries so far, with numerous more ahead. His recovery efforts, including extensive physical therapy, will take many years. His mother is now at his bedside. Sergeant Vargas Andrews is the embodiment of the United States Marine Corps institutional core values of honor, courage, and commitment. As a young man, he knew he wanted to be a U.S. Marine and stayed true to that vision. While stationed in Kabul, Afghanistan, he shared the experience of reuniting Afghan children with their families in a situation that was tenuous and chaotic, which brought him great joy and made his mission worthwhile. Sergeant Vargas Andrews joined the Marine Corps on August 28, 2017, and is assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines, based at Camp Pendleton. He graduated from Folsom High School in 2016, has a passion for baseball and soccer. The latter he played with several junior leagues, high school teams, and Folsom Lake College. He is from Folsom, California. The family expresses their sincere gratitude for all the prayers, support, and fundraising efforts now underway to support Sergeant Vargas Andrews' long-term recovery efforts. Hashtag Tyler USMC Strong. That's a statement from the family.
Thank you so much for sharing that, and also just giving us a glimpse of his medical journey. He's undergoing his 18th surgery. Joey, I just am curious, what is your relationship with the family, and really what led to this generous idea of throwing a special in his honor with the goal of raising more funds for his family?
Well, I myself don't know Tyler. I've worked with his cousin now for going on 4 years. His cousin Taylor out of Wheatland. She's a real estate agent in Wheatland. And when she told me about it, it hit me really hard, and I wanted to do something to help raise funds for the family. Incidentally, Tyler is getting married this weekend at our house, so that's how close we are basically with Tyler.
That's wonderful, and thank you for sharing that. I wish them, you know, the very best with their wedding that's just taking place in a couple days. You know, Mike, you're a veteran as well. Can you share your story? And because when we briefly talked, I mean, this really just adds a deeper layer of significance given the experience that you had. Hello,
is Mike there?
He is there. We're having a little bit of audio issues.
Well, let me say something about Mike while you're fixing the audio issues. I'm very honored to have Mike on board. Mike was in the Navy. Mike was there 20 years ago when this whole thing started, basically, as a 20-something-year-old kid himself. And I'm very honored to have Mike. All the comics that are joining us, Ellis Rodriguez and the others, Ellis was in the Marine Corps. Greg was in the Army, and I've got just Army brats or women married, female comics married to somebody in the Marine Corps, one in the Army, and so they're all military people, and they're given their time for free to help raise funds for Tyler.
Yeah, Mike, can you hear us now?
Can you guys hear me now?
Yes. Hi, Mike.
Yes, at the box. You know, awesome.
Before we get into that, we only have a couple minutes left. I want to make sure people know the who, what, where, like how they can go to this benefit show and support the Vargas Andrews family. So where is this taking place and how can people get more information?
It's going to be at Joey's house. He has got 5 acres of land, and he decided to open his home to everybody. And the address is on the flyer, and we'll also have that attached with the GoFundMe account as well.
You know, if you just briefly can talk to us before we close, just, you know, as I was asking you, you know, as a veteran, you know, what added significance does this whole experience give to you and your service?
Well, it's full circle. I was there at the beginning. My ship was the first ship to break ground in Afghanistan back in 2001. And we thought we did our job. We thought it was mission accomplished. And then unfortunately, 20 years later, it wasn't. And unfortunately, Tyler and the 13 fallen soldiers and Marines were attacked on. And it feels like every veteran that's been through this war, we feel like we failed. And doing this benefit show, we're not going to fail. We're going to give back. And the best way to give back is through the power of laughter. I know it's a hard, heavy subject to talk about, but as a comedian, we're going to give back and we're going to make people laugh and we're going to take this pain away. And we're going to raise money for Tyler. Well, the great thing about raising money for Tyler and his family is, you know, honestly, it takes about $1 million to send a Marine to boot camp and go through training and then go to war. So we're gonna get those. I think we can raise $1 million for Tyler and his family, because I've never met him, but he's a brother to me. And we're gonna help our fellow fallen brother.
And really, I mean, just to date, I mean, it's over $300,000 have been raised for his family, which is just incredible, given everything that they're enduring. Mike and Joey C., thank you so much for joining us and sharing your benefit show. We have the flyer and a link on our Insight page.
Yes, thank you for having us. We're going to have a good time. Like I said, I'm excited to make people laugh, because that's what we comedians do best. We're just going to make everyone forget about the pain and just have a great time.
Yep, that is correct. Laughter is great medicine. That is Mike Betancourt and Joey C. They're hosting the Tyler Vargas Andrews Benefit Show in honor of the Folsom Marine Sergeant severely injured during suicide bombings in Kabul. The show takes place October 14th in the city of Lincoln, and we have a flyer on our Insight page. That's it for Insight today. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.